This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Matt Rubin has developed an electric motor technology and a kidney health diagnostic, and held leadership positions in Indiana University's technology commercialization and entrepreneurship and innovation areas. But it's the work he and his team did every week for 4 years in a small Indianapolis prep kitchen that laid the foundation for his growing industrial flavor company. Matt founded True Essence in 2021. Less than 2 years in, it has 24 employees and has raised more than $12 million of funding. Matt, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Kathleen, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You and your team got together every week for 4 years, not being paid, by the way, and worked with chocolate to develop your technology. Why chocolate, and what was your process for developing the technology?
Sure. Well, unlike loaves of bread, which are really hard to compare from week to week, chocolate is a great medium for detecting and discovering and comparing flavors. So you can have a chocolate bar that was from a batch 4 weeks ago and compare it side by side with the chocolate bar that you just made. And so it was a beautiful medium for discovering flavor. Many consumers have had grapes and many consumers have had raisins, and they expect a difference. And you typically understand that the raisin doesn't quite taste as fresh as the grape. In chocolate, we had the inverse experience where we were used to what we bought at the store. But when we experienced fresh chocolate, there was an entire palette of aroma and flavor that we never knew existed in fresh chocolate. And so that led us down the path. Once we tasted that experience, and 1 teaspoon of chocolate made in a mortar and pestle, we mapped out, well, why aren't we selling this? What happened to chocolate? And we came up with about 22 different process steps. We assumed as a team that it's going to take us a lot of failure to get to the finish line. So we said there's about 10 failures per process step, average rate of about 1 week per failure. And that will result in you do the math together, that's about 4.5 years of R&D if you're changing one variable at a time. And so that's what we focused on doing.
And these process steps, you have a lot of patents on what you did. You describe broadly this process you put together as flavor balancing and flavor symmetry. Tell us about that.
So in the process of chocolate making, one of the key steps is a dehydration process with the industry calls conching. And so the chocolate starts at about 4.5% moisture by weight, and you have to get it down to less than 1.25. Otherwise, it's very thick and almost cement-like. The challenge is that chocolate burns at 120 degrees and you usually conch above 180. So we developed a technology, and we said, as a rule of thumb, I love the things that everyone in a factory or everyone in a kitchen can remember. So we came out with this rule. We said, if the room smells like chocolate, the chocolate doesn't smell like chocolate. Which sounds kind of quirky, but everyone, you know, panicked when the room smelled delicious, which was a fun culture to have. Our flavor symmetry technology allows us in a hermetically sealed environment to dehydrate foods where we separate water from flavor to enable dry foods such as chocolate, fruit juices, fresh ginger to be completely dried into a shelf stable form, but still have all the potency of aroma and freshness that you would expect.
I love the focus on the smell thing. You won a science fair when you were in fifth grade, right? For something about smelling?
Yeah, the sensitivity of smelling. We looked at, it was a statewide science fair where we compared across 7 different receptors that, you know, it was a bunch of film canisters in a cardboard box that had cereal dilutions, but the science was really, really sound. And so smell has been a fascination my entire life.
So, you know, when you talk about it, you've talked to me about the blueberry peak that you pulled out of chocolate. It's easy to hear the words and not understand. So you sent me some samples, and I called my friend, who's a food scientist, and we sat down and we tested some of these samples. We tested, I'm delighted to say, tequila and some other alcohols and turmeric and ginger. And Scott, this food scientist, couldn't get over how you're able to remove what he called the burn or the bite.
Yeah. So our complementary technology is what we call flavor balancing. which takes away that bite. If you're walking through an apple orchard and you pick an apple up off the ground, you bite into it, it's probably fermented. You're probably going to shake your head and want to spit it out. And that's the same bite, that physiological response that you get from drinking bitter coffee. It's the same bite that you get from a dark chocolate bar. And what we found was that in fermented foods, whether you're beer, wine, spirits, kombucha, chocolate, coffee, et cetera, there's something in the food as a result of that fermentation that tells you, don't eat this, it's been rotten. And that bite that you get in tequila and everything else is that signal that says, don't consume this. We figured out how to select and rebalance that to allow the peaks of the agave and the tequila or of the different origins of coffee bean to really shine without distracting you with the finish.
So you made the tequila more dangerous.
It is more delicious. Yes.
So what's fascinating to me is you made this chocolate. You spent all this. You were working your day job. You made this chocolate. You spent all this time doing it in your weekends and free time. And you developed a consumer product called, is it Sochati?
Correct.
Yeah. And you sell this chocolate. But that wasn't your end goal, wasn't to create consumer products. You're leasing equipment to food manufacturers and having them pay fees for using it.
How's Correct. That? So our industrial business model, you can think of us as a mechanical flavor house. So rather than most food production starts where when you look at flavor in food, it's really how do I process the food? How do I cook it and finish it? And then how do I add flavor back to it just before it goes into packaging, to whether it's a seasoning or a spice or some type of an extract, to really add back some of those aromas that were lost during the process. We took a different approach and we said, what happens if we just do no harm through the industrial manufacturing process and preserve the natural flavor fingerprint that already exists in food and then help to rebalance it? And so as an industrial flavor house, we work with our customers to install and scale these solutions to give, at the end of the day, the consumers this much greater potency of flavor and balance, but through a non-additive and sustainable meat.
Spread the flavor.
It does. So Chadi was our proof of product for the industrial customers. When we could say, yes, we're already using this industrially, that accelerates the conversation by years. We're not working with people and saying, hey, we discovered this at an R&D laboratory somewhere that this may work. We get to say, we've been using this for many years at industrial scale. It works. And that was really the goal of Sochati.
So as you've alluded, you believe your technology can improve flavors and make more shelf-stable a whole range of foods and beverages, juice, concentrates, herbs, spices, cannabinoids, fruits, vegetables, alcohol, beer, coffee. It goes on and on, right? So how are you deciding which industries to market your equipment to first?
We have been fortunate over the last year where many industrial customers have come to us. So we went from 1 to nearly 40 industrial engagements by word of mouth alone with some of the largest household names in the food industry. And so we work with local companies, regional companies to accelerate the development in a particular field. And then we work with some of the largest companies in the industry to industrialize and make sure it gets to as many people as possible. We, as a company, wanted to not get pigeonholed within one market sector and show and demonstrate the technology's applicability across an industry to drive change.
How did all these companies find you?
Many by word of mouth. They simply, like your colleague, tasted the samples. They called the people that they used to work with at different companies and said, hey, you guys have to try this.
Yeah, you know, the first reaction Scott had when he tasted, I think we started with turmeric, he looked at me and he said, I'm so jealous.
We recognize as a team that we have a very large responsibility for enabling these industries. But with just the fresh fruits and vegetables and even the herbs, we enable substitution to shelf-stable products where you would previously not accept it. So you don't look at shelf-stable products as you buy a bag of carrots. You don't think about shelf-stable carrots, but the amount of food waste that we have the potential to decrease and the amount of shelf life that we're able to increase, we have a responsibility to really expand this technology industrially. And it's really exciting for our team.
Well, another example of that is, you know, you gave us a little sample of apple juice, but it was concentrated. And so what you're saying is you don't need a big jug of apple juice to travel across the country, it can be a little jar of concentrate that's not frozen that tastes good when you put water in.
Yeah. Our day-to-day at our company starts with observation. We said, why does your juice concentrate live in the freezer and your honey lives in the cabinet? We said, why? Well, using our technology, we can make apple juice like honey, and then it can live in the cabinet. And that was the goal of the entire fruit nectar. And we looked at this, and it was about a 30% cost reduction of the total, 30% of the wholesale value was in cold chain logistics. There's a ton of energy, there's logistical waste, and then there's the security risk of what happens if it actually heats up to room temperature. Does it spoil? How do I track spoilage? And so by turning it into a shelf-stable product, you get to remove the burden of the shrinkage that you would have as a food industry. And it really has taken off with one of our industrial licenses in particular.
So part of there's a big sustainability play here. And part of it is you don't need as many refrigerated trucks. Stuff is smaller, so I assume you don't need as much packaging. Any other ways that you make things more sustainable?
Yeah, when we thought about sustainability, we really wanted to make sure that we had a way to reconcile a balanced approach. So I didn't want to make one thing sustainable and create two problems somewhere else. And so we said, so for something to truly be sustainable, it has to be sustainable across food, energy, transportation, water, and waste management. And so we said, well, we're recapturing the water at the source. So a byproduct of our process for industrial dehydration captures the water. So you're producing thousands of gallons of distilled water that is completely potable. We use less energy in our transportation and our processing and conventional processes. And then you have increased food because you have decreased shrinkage. So in herbs, you may have 40 to 60% shrinkage by the time you even get to the point of sale. And so it's multifaceted. We've had facilities that have replaced some of their fresh herbs with some of the True Essence shelf-stable herbs, and they decreased their purchasing by over 90% of the herbs that they used during a season for mint juleps alone.
And just to be clear, too, there are so many kind of chemicals and such used in American food production. This is not a chemical process you're talking about, right?
No, this is not at all. This is it's a non-additive process. So we said, well, if we remove the water, the concentration of everything else just increases. The tide goes up for everything else. So you don't have to salt a food to make it shelf stable. It already has salt in it. You don't have to sugar a food. It already has sugar. You just have to remove enough water that the concentration of those enable it to be shelf stable. And that's what we focused on.
When we tasted that turmeric and the ginger, neither of us had ever tasted something that was so flavorful, a dried spice that was so flavorful, I guess.
This is one of the most exciting byproducts of some of the things that we're seeing is that by concentrating the products, the flavor potency in some of these products is rising to the level of creating an emotional response where even in fresh form, it doesn't. And so we're seeing people have smiles and just these big emotional waves come over their body. And so there's not just is it exactly what they would expect in ginger, but it's more ginger than ginger, if that makes any sense. And it's really exciting to see.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Gordon Daly initially thought the funeral home director's idea of live streaming funerals was a little strange, but intriguing. He had a side hustle with his buddies, so they decided to try to build a live streaming platform. By 2010, they'd filed their first patent, and by 2013, Gordon had left his job at Rockwell Automation to work full-time on their new startup. Today, Cleveland-based Boxcast has a plug-and-play live streaming platform that powers millions of broadcasts around the world. The company has more than 75 employees and has raised more than $20 million of investor funding. Gordon, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
When you started Boxcast, live streaming was in its infancy. YouTube had its first live event in 2008. Did your experiences at Rockwell help inform how you thought about building a live stream platform?
For sure, my experiences did at Rockwell. I think in addition to live streaming, just the experience in working at a big company is helpful to entrepreneurs because they learn how to work with a lot of different kinds of people and a certain level of professionalism or polish that really works well as you're trying to build a company. But specifically about live streaming, it was, I think, centering around two things, the needs of the customer and how valuable it is to automate something, because that's what we ended up doing, is automating video streaming.
You told Rockwell about this side gig, and you stayed there in the early days of the company. So you were making sales calls for Boxcast during your lunch hour, on vacation. How did you do this?
Well, you just had to find a way to make it happen. And we didn't feel comfortable doing and working on this without our employer knowing. So we thought the right thing to do would be to tell them about it. I'm really happy that we did. And I'm really impressed with how Rockwell handled the situation. They didn't overreact or act afraid of it. And I will say that it certainly benefited them tremendously because we continued to work there for years after that.
So you would use your vacation time. You told me one of those vacations you were at a funeral directors conference.
Yeah, that was the first one we went to, interestingly enough. Yeah, a funerals director conference was where we went to sell video streaming. And it was a very strange environment. I'd never been to one before. I was expecting caskets and hearses, but wasn't really prepared for all the other parts of the industry that you don't normally think about, with embalming fluids and the motor tools used to take care of bodies. But it was an interesting opportunity for us to go and see what the needs were. But one of the things I learned as an entrepreneur is maybe not all markets you have the passion to pursue are worth going after, because starting a company is hard. And it's really important to wake up every morning having the drive to want to see something happen. And the death care industry really wasn't the top of our bucket list.
But you had started there and you realized that there were a lot of people who couldn't get to a funeral who wanted to watch a funeral. So it was a pretty lucrative market, right?
I think that there's a lot of business opportunity in the market. And it's a really, really important market too, because you're right. You're connecting people that couldn't otherwise be at the event. But rewind that clock 15 years, and you know, it was kind of a strange foreign thought. I'll never forget my wife asking me, you know, what we're going to name the company. And I was thinking, let's keep it simple. Let's call it a camera in a box or a camera in a can. And she said, no, you can't do that because they're going to think it's in the coffin. And it made us laugh at the time, but it was a strange foreign thought to think that you would stream something like that. But now it makes perfect sense, because this is how you help people through the grieving process, is to be a part of that ceremony.
You were low on resources in the early days and trying to do your job at Rockwell well. How did you'd go to a conference, you would have to show your product in the exhibit hall. I mean, would you haul a monitor to the conference?
It's funny you asked that question, because, you would if you had one. And some of these trips required plane trips. And yeah, so we would take our vacation time. We'd pay for the hotel and the flight to get there, but shipping equipment was just too expensive. You know, one funny story that comes to mind that was that when we rented the hotel room, you know, it was our impression that we were renting everything in the hotel room. So to solve the monitor problem, we would borrow the TV just for a few hours, or what hours we were at the show, and bring it back, which was maybe a strange thing to do. But when you're hustling to make things work, and we always return it, of course, in good condition, it was a little tricky sneaking in and out of the hotel. We had to cover it in sheets and always got some strange looks as we were walking down the hallway with large televisions. But it's just a part of the hustle story, you know, and finding a way to make it happen.
There are a lot of ways now, we know there are a lot of ways to stream where you can do it for free. You can do it with your iPhone. So why does someone want to pay a monthly fee to use Boxcast to stream?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why if you're an organization, you start to think about it. One is just the ease of how it gets done. An iPhone's nice. And of course, we offer an iPhone app too that has incredible quality. But if you want to use real cameras and real sound equipment, it's a lot easier just to have maybe one of our devices on site to handle all that for you. The quality's a lot higher. If you stream on Facebook, you don't get to also have the video show up in YouTube or in some of these other social media networks because they're competitors, right? With Boxcast, you stream to one place and it goes everywhere. The branding is a concern. Some people want to own that brand on their own site, not worry about commercials or censorship issues. And it's not just whether they like the content you're streaming. Sometimes people might have music that they're running in the background, which would cause the video to completely cut out because it would be violating some terms that they probably are getting false positive censorship for. So I could go on and on and on and on, but paid service for live streaming makes a ton of sense, which is why we've been such a successful business.
So tell me, if I'm using Boxcast, it's a box, right, that I plug in?
It can be, because for people that aren't technical enough to use all the other equipment that's out there for video broadcasting, which we're compatible with, we've made it easy to just have it all fit in a little box that has as much performance or more performance than a computer might be able to do. And it's optimized for it. There's so much to just setting and forgetting and making everything work. And that's one of the value propositions that really helped us get to where we're at, is that people just found our product so easy to use and so reliable that they didn't want to have to mess with all the extra cables and network connections and different devices to plug together when they could just pop it into this one little device and it all just works.
And what am I plugging your box into?
It might be into a camera that's on site. If you rewind time, there's always been cameras at sporting events, but that video never went anywhere. That's when we knew that there was a need for this, is because we saw people spend a lot of time recording this content, but then no one would ever be able to see it because it was so much work to get it off of the camera, get it compressed small down enough to be able to upload it. Whereas when you're live streaming it in real time, the second that event is complete, the video is already where people can get access to it. You don't have to do any extra work to move it around.
So your Boxcast grew steadily for years. And then in 2020, along came COVID. How did that impact your business?
Well, the business had been growing pretty well after COVID, but it completely changed the second that COVID hit. I think I went back and looked at the peak usage just within a few weeks of COVID and the lockdowns happening. We saw like a 20x increase at peak usage time of how much it was needed. And we were so thankful that we had good engineering effort to build it so that we could survive that kind of growth, because it's crazy to think that overnight, almost, well, over just a few number of weeks, you're going to increase the amount of demand by 20x. But of course, the business benefited tremendously from that. And it really changed the trajectory of the business.
What kinds of, your focus is funerals and sporting events. Was that true after COVID? Did you expand more?
When we first started the business, the funeral homes weren't quite ready to buy it as fast as we would have needed them to. It was sports in the beginning. Division III, Division II, Division I sporting teams that had their parents paying lots of money to have their kids play on these teams, and they wanted to be able to watch them. So that was the first application that really drove demand. And it wasn't too long after that that churches also started to have more of a need to do this. Fast forwarding to today, we have a lot of exciting sports customers. I think we have almost a dozen Major League Soccer teams. We have Major League Baseball team, a number of others, lots of semi-pro teams. But the market that probably might surprise you that our focus is largest on is churches. There's just so many churches in America, and they are doing weddings and funerals and regular services. These ceremonies, quite frankly, kind of chronicle the life of a human being as they're going from birth to death. And we're a part of that every individual's life the whole way. So churches has been, by and large, our largest customers, and we're excited to serve them well.
Did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
I didn't know what an entrepreneur was when I was younger. I guess I just naturally was. It was in high school when they gave us graphing calculators, which were the neatest devices. I didn't really have a computer at home until I was a little bit later into high school. But they gave us these graphing calculators, and I did make a blackjack poker app that became pretty popular in school. And I think I learned pretty quickly that I undercharged for it. But it wasn't long before that got snuffed out, and I could no longer really make money on that app in school because it became too much of a distraction. But I think it's maybe the first time I realized that I had an aptitude to do this kind of thing. But once I got into college and out of college, and I just couldn't stop with different ideas in my head, I think it became pretty natural that I think that way.
What's your best tip for other entrepreneurs?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is you can't go alone. Entrepreneurs think they have this great idea and they want to do whatever it takes to get the job done. The reality is the world's just too big. Running a business, there's too many different facets in a business to think that you can do it all yourself. And there are tools that are out there, but you need to surround yourself with people that know their level of expertise and that you can depend on, and really get those people to come alongside. Even if it's in an informal way to give you guidance, to save you the time, because you can't Google everything. It's so nash for people to think that they can solve every problem by Googling, but time is the only thing that you can't get back. So, for the sake of speed, get people to help you that can. And I think that once you've identified something that just drives you, that you can't stop yourself from doing, that you wake up every morning thinking about and having to chase over because you're just so curious as to what's on the other side, that's when you know you're in the right spot as an entrepreneur, and that's when you need to make a run for it.
That's when you're delegated to the roller coaster of entrepreneurship, right?
It's terrible. I'll be honest with you. It is terrible. Yeah, I don't know why people would do it to themselves, put themselves through that, unless they just can't help it. And I think that's what I mean by entrepreneurs being wired. I think that entrepreneurs just can't help it. It's just something that is so convicting to an individual. And I do think that different people can get the bug. But once you're convicted and you can't stop pursuing it because you know it has to be done, that's the trigger, I think, in your mind to stick it out. Because if you have the courage to stick it out, and sometimes it takes longer than you think, the market, as long as you're still ahead of it, will come. And when it's ready, you take advantage of it. That's when you're happy you did. I mean, it happened with us with COVID. When we first started BoxCast, I knew that streaming was something everybody needed to do. It just took a lot longer than I expected, and a pandemic, for the rest of the world to catch up to that.
Well, it's been awesome hearing your story and hearing you admit that there are good and bad days. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. My pleasure.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.